Support for Access Utah comes from Crumb Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches. Welcome to Access Utah. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and I'm joined in studio by Mark Anderson of Anderson Seed and Garden in Logan. And if you have any questions or comments, we'd like to take them at 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. Or go online to upr.org, click on the Programs tab, and you'll see Access Utah, and you can email us your question there. Mark, thanks for coming in.
You're very welcome.
Well, I loved yesterday. It was just like perfect spring weather for me. And it's going to be warming up again today, but then we might get rain and snow tomorrow. So it's typical spring weather.
It's been a great spring. We just can't complain. I mean, we've had some really warm days. We've had some cold, wet days. I mean, it's a lot more normal than it has been.
We are 2 weeks. I've noticed everything is 2 weeks earlier in my garden than it normally would be.
And everything last year was 2 or 3 weeks late. So we were just commenting the other day that, you know, last year lilacs bloomed so late we couldn't even use them for Memorial Day because they bloomed after Memorial Day. And this year they're all blooming right now and they'll probably be bloomed out by Memorial Day. So, and it's just like one extreme follows the next. So,
well, one thing that I've had in my garden that I have just enjoyed immensely because it's really come into production is my asparagus patch. We get, you know, you get those bundles in the store. I've been getting one of those a day.
Oh, that's not bad.
And so, and it's starting to pick up from there because I've got a second row that next year will really in full production.
Get going. Yeah. Oh, that's great. That's wonderful. Yeah. So, no complaints about the spring weather. You know, we've had 3 or 4, maybe even 5 nice warm days in between, you know, 2 or 3 wet days where we're still getting some nice moisture. And we had almost an inch of rain last week. So, you know, we're getting some good moisture coming down. Plants are starting to, seeds are germinating like crazy. Plants are getting established. We just can't complain too much.
I just hope it doesn't get too hot too fast because I put my peas in on March 17th, St. Patrick's Day, and they're looking really good.
They're looking good. Didn't get nipped with frost the other night.
No, it didn't. I think that's because I've got a barn on the upslope side of the peas, so it kind of protected them just a little bit.
Yeah. All of our plants did really well. Dad has a few potatoes that got hit a little bit, but we were about 27.
I wondered how cold it got to.
It was pretty chilly. So I'm sure there's a lot of people throughout at least Cache Valley that had some loss on a few things. But you know, it's Cache Valley, and we know we're going to have a frost sometime in May as well. So just be prepared. And I think our full moon's around the 10th or the 12th of this month. So that's a good time to watch out for frost.
Oh, is that
it's usually around the full moon. Yeah, it's usually around the full moon. So I haven't looked at the calendar specifically, but I think it's right around the 10th or the 12th. So,
well, I'll find out here in the next month how many apples I'll still have because it was kind of right at.
You know, there's some blossoms that were probably open that may have got damaged, but some that hadn't opened up yet that'll still open and maybe it'll just naturally thin them for us.
So I don't have to do it myself.
Yes, exactly.
One of those tasks that I detest doing because I keep thinking, oh, these poor apples, I'm breaking them off.
But thinning the apples is never fun. I don't.
But it makes a huge difference.
Oh, it makes a huge difference. That's for sure. Yeah, that's for sure.
I've also learned that you have to do it early enough. Otherwise, if you thin them later, the tree has already, I was talking to the fruit specialist here at the university. He said, if you don't do it by about the end of May, the tree has already set what it's going to do for next year.
For next year.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So I'm like, okay, fine. That explains why my Jonagold was always still going every other year bearing because I wasn't doing it early enough.
Wasn't getting it thinned out soon enough. Yeah, that's a possibility. So.
Well, I wanted to start out talking about strawberries. We've got a nice little strawberry patch that we put in last year. This is supposed to be my son's patch, but by the weeds that are coming up in it, it may end up being my patch. But and I'm trying to even remember the variety that I planted, but I know I ordered some this year. Seascape was the name of it.
Okay.
It was recommended to me. And
that's one that I'm familiar with, yeah.
And have you grown it
Never
before?
Grown it, but we've talked to one of our growers about it, and they say it's pretty good. It's definitely more of a West Coast variety, so it should do pretty well here. But it was developed for like Oregon, I think. So
I'm just trying to bring a little taste of the Northwest, and we'll see what happens. I'll let you know. So okay, so with strawberries, part of the problem, depending on where you live, and I noticed when I lived in Mendon growing up, I never had to put iron on strawberries.
Yeah,
I don't think they really have to do it too much in Paradise, depending on where they are. So that it's really the pH is really close. But I know in Hyde Park, if I didn't put iron on my strawberries, yikes!
They would just go
way yellow, yeah. And I don't get any production out of them. And so.
And, you know, last year where we had such a wet spring, we really saw a lot of iron chlorosis in the plants because a lot of that available iron was leached out of the plants, or not out of the plants, out of the soil. And so they just didn't have that iron available to them. And it's probably going to be a problem again this year if you haven't supplemented that just a little bit. You know, we do have iron that is naturally available in the soil, but our pH is so high. You know, with all the alkalinity that we have, you know, all of our water runs over 5 million limestones on the way down the canyon. So the pH of the soil is just high here because it's all limestone based, and without adding a little sulfur to the soil, bringing that pH down, a lot of times the iron's bound up in the soil and is unavailable to the plants. So they just can't use the iron that's there because it's tied up in the soil.
So if you haven't put anything on your strawberries or even your raspberries at this point, you can still do that, correct?
Oh absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, definitely not too late. You know, there's a lot of different varieties of iron out there. You know, of course, a chelated iron is going to be much quicker, and you're going to see results a lot faster on your plants because it's broken down. It's pre-digested for the plants, so the plants can pick it up and utilize that nutrient much, much quicker. And then depending on how it's chelated, in many cases it won't get bound up by your soil pH. So if your pH is really high, there's certain kinds of chelated iron that you can use that will not get bound up in the soil.
So not just any chelated iron. If you don't want it to get bound up, what should you be looking for?
We're looking for either, there's three kinds that I'm aware of. There's Miller's Ferroplus. There's the Growmore EDDHA, which is the same thing, and Sequestrian 138. Those are all chelated so that they will work in soil pHs above 7.5. And for the most part, Cache Valley, you know, Wasatch Front, everybody's pH is probably in that 7, 7.5, 8.
Probably Southern
maybe
Utah,
even
especially.
Higher range, yeah. And so that's probably the best option. Of course, it's a little bit more expensive, but it works when nothing else, you know, when nothing else works at all. So that's a good one. There's also the iron chelate DP from Miller's, which will work up to about 7.5, maybe 8. That's a very good one also. And Growmore has that, as they call. There's the 10% organic chelated iron, and then there's Sequestrian 330, and those are all three, again, the same varieties, but work just a little bit differently. So the 138, it's a red powder. Yeah, it's kind of a reddish color, kind of a rusty red color.
And I've seen it come in a, was it a 5-pound tub?
Comes in a 5-pound or 1-pound, just depends on how much you want to spend.
Does volume, purchasing it in volume, help bring the cost down a little bit?
A little bit less expensive. It's just that super chelated iron just is a little bit expensive to begin with. Usually runs about $20 a pound, and for 4 pounds, I think it's like $69, somewhere.
Yikes,
somewhere in that
that's
range.
Gone up since the last time purchased it.
It's gone up a little bit.
Oy.
And then the 330 is more of a yellowish color. I would say the 2-pounders run about $15, so that's probably the best way to buy it is in those 2-pound containers, and then the 5-pounders like closer to $60, so it's definitely gone up in price on that one. So the 2-pounders are definitely the best way to go.
Well, and you definitely want to put this on judiciously, and what I like to do is take those big salt shakers,
yeah,
and I just go like this all over the ground and kind of just rake it in a little bit.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And I like doing it just before a storm comes through, because you don't want to leave this on the leaves because it'll burn the leaves.
Right. I usually do a soil application, put it on the ground around the plants, and then water it very lightly because it's highly water soluble. So as soon as water hits it, it just dissolves and then just is absorbed right into the soil where the root system can pick it up. So, you know, there's some very good liquid forms as well too. So locally made, there's a Bicor's iron combo chelate, which has a complement of micronutrients in it, not just the iron.
And that can be sprayed right on the plant?
That can be sprayed right on the plant, yeah. I found with the spray, it works very quickly, but it doesn't last quite as long.
So basically, it's just in the vegetation and the plant's
yeah,
not drawing
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah. And so okay. If you have a severe iron deficiency, sometimes you've got to go to more of a soil application where the foliar won't just quite do it. And, you know, it just depends on how big the tree or the shrub is, too, if you're trying to do a big tree or big shrub, and how much you end up using. So,
well, let's back up and describe what iron chlorosis looks like for those maybe who are not familiar with it, but have yeah. often wondered, why is my tree so yellow?
Yeah, so there's certain varieties of plants that tend to be a little bit more needy when it comes to the iron. So you've got strawberries and raspberries, of course, and maples. Most of your maples tend to be a little
silver
iron deficient.
Maples.
Silver maples yeah. especially, yeah. But burning bush, or commonly we see that in the burning bush as well too. So basically what you're looking at is in the newest growth, the growth that has just recently come out on the plants. It's usually the most susceptible to the iron deficiency, and you'll see a discoloring of the leaves. They'll go from a dark green to a much lighter green, or even to a yellow, and you'll see dark green veins running through the leaves. As the iron chlorosis gets worse, they'll go really pale, and you won't even see the dark green veins running through the leaves. They'll just be a real pale color. When they're pale like that, they're much more susceptible to wind and sunburn. And so then you'll get brown crisping along the edges, and eventually it'll just brown the whole leaf up, and they'll just basically fall off the tree. But almost always happens in the newest growth first, gradually working its way back into some of the older growth, and you'll see that venation, those little dark green veins running through the leaves, is almost a telltale sign. It happens in a lot of evergreens too. You will see it in junipers. They'll be nice dark green, and then you'll have just kind of a yellowing out on the tips of the junipers. So we see it in junipers and yews and boxwoods as well. So it's a fairly common problem. It's something that most yards have an issue with
somewhere.
Yeah, it's not like the whole yard, but just, you know, bits and pieces at least.
I know I have an apple that it's a gala, and
yeah.
I've been told that they're kind of susceptible to that anyway, and it's yeah. done okay in my yard until the last 2 years, and then last year it really got hit.
Yeah,
and I almost lost a couple of branches on just one side of the tree, which is funny. I mean, the other side is just fine.
It's fine, yeah.
But this west side, I finally came in and purchased some iron plugs actually drilled some holes in the tree and
put
pushed
them in
those in. And now it seems to be coming out
yeah.
pretty good
yeah,
this
I think
year.
You'll be surprised how nice it will look this spring, because those implants do a really, really good job.
So how long does it take the plant to take up this, if it's sequestrian 138,
yeah.
for instance?
Generally, I would say probably as it starts to absorb it up through the root system and spread it through the plant, probably about a foot to 2 feet a day is how quickly it'll spread through that tree. So if it's a 15-foot tree, it might take 2 weeks to see a difference in it. With the sequestrian 138, the EDDHA, that's probably going to be the fastest. So absorbed the quickest and also the most mobile in the plant. So you're going to see that move the quickest. Some of the other varieties are going to be a little bit slower. If you were to do something like iron sulfate, which is a great way to go in the fall, very inexpensive, you know, high iron, you know, sulfur helps lower the pH, you know, breaks the iron down so the plants can get it. Sometimes it takes 2 months for that to break down into a form that the trees or the shrubs can actually utilize it. So that's why we like to use it in the fall, because through winter it'll get broken down, and the plants will be able to use it the first thing in the spring. It's not just always readily available to the plants, so it really depends on the variety of iron that you're applying.
So if you use iron sulfate, you still would have to put it on in the spring, I'm assuming. Does the plant use up everything from the winter?
You know, as it sits out there through the winter and breaks down a little bit where the plant can start to use it, I like to do it twice a year if I'm using the iron sulfate. So I'll do one in the fall, I'll do one in the spring.
So there's a continuous supply.
Yeah, so it's kind of a continuous supply there for the plants. But the key really is to lower that pH and free up that iron and make it available. I mean, almost every year I always have, you know, multiple customers come in and say, you know, I've been using iron on my plants, but they're just not greening up. And then we find out what kind they're using. They're using like ironite, or, you know, ironite only has like 4% iron in it. It has hardly any sulfur in it. So if your pH is really high, you can just dump ironite on your plants and they will never.
So the name's kind of a misnomer.
They will never ever get that iron. I mean, it'll just sit out there and just be bound up in the soil where the plants can never utilize it. So it just really depends on the variety that you're using.
So that when you say iron sulfate, that's the sulfur that's being applied at the same time?
Right. So iron sulfate's like 19% iron and 16% sulfur, or vice versa. I can't remember which is which, but it's those two percentages. And so it's got a higher sulfur along with the higher iron. And so as it breaks down, that sulfur takes probably 6 or 8 weeks to lower the pH of the soil, and it'll gradually free that iron up and make it available to the plants.
Does the sulfur move through the soil, or do you have to get it in to the soil profile where the roots are?
You know, the sulfur is kind of water insoluble. Depending on which one you use, it's kind of slow to do its thing. So it's really best if you can kind of incorporate it into the soil so it doesn't like wash away or anything. But once it's in there, it'll pretty much stay there and do its job for the summertime.
Okay.
So not too bad.
Well, we're talking about gardens and iron sulfate at this point, but we've got other questions to come up, and hopefully have yours as well at 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495, or go online to upr.org, click on the programs tab, and send us an email question through the Access Utah link. Mark Anderson from Anderson Seed and Garden in Logan is my guest. And Mark, just one more question about the iron that you put on. How long is it going to last? Am I going to need to do it? If I do the quick uptake iron, am I going to have to do that again?
It'll last the whole season.
Okay.
Yeah, you really should get it to last the whole season, so probably once a year. And again, it just depends on how severe the iron deficiency your plants have, you know, how severe it is. And using one of those super chelated varieties of iron, it will probably last longer and be more available to the plants quicker than some of the other varieties. But once you get that initial yellowing of the plant taken care of, then you could use something slower that would just kind of provide them a constant source of iron over time, and then maybe switch to the iron sulfate, which is much, much less expensive, but again, much slower to react. And so you'd really want to use that in the fall instead of trying to fix a problem with it.
So once you get into a pattern of applying some of the iron sulfate in the fall and then in the spring,
do you have to use the
other?
Should be pretty good. You know, okay. Especially you were talking strawberries right off, you know, on the earlier in the show. And if you use a product like Iron Plus on those, the Iron Plus has like 11% nitrogen, which the strawberries love. They like that extra nitrogen. It's really great for raspberries too. And then it has about the same combination of iron and sulfur in it as the iron sulfate. So it's basically iron sulfate plus the little bit of nitrogen. That's a great way to fertilize your raspberries or your strawberries or your grapes, kind of perennially have iron chlorosis issues. And it's constantly providing them with a source of iron and also giving them a little bit of nitrogen to encourage some growth, and it really keeps them green, looking good. And once you can kind of use that every year, a little bit on your plants just to keep them happy, and they'll just go like crazy.
So really, I should be putting the iron sulfate underneath my apple tree as well.
Yeah.
Do the same thing with that.
Yeah. And the iron sulfate's just, you know, ferrous sulfate. So, you know, if you're gardening organically or, you know, however, it'll be just a great option for you. It'll do a good job. And in many cases, the chelated varieties of iron have been chelated with organic amino acids also. And so without having an OMRI certification label on them, they're basically 100% organic also. So
let's back up then and talk about strawberries in particular. So a lot of people are buying them now.
Yeah.
And they're going to put them in. How deep should you plant a strawberry? You've got your bed prepared. You've got your iron that you've put in
yes,
there.
Yes.
What kind of nutrient? What kind of nutrient should go in there?
Yeah. Usually with the strawberries and raspberries, especially, I'll try and stay away from steer compost because the steer compost carries a lot of diseases that affect strawberries and raspberries and affect their growth patterns. And so I'll try and steer away from a steer compost, no pun intended, and go more to a poultry compost. So we really like our soil building compost, which is a finely ground redwood bark that has poultry manure and bat guano and worm castings and kelp meal and calcium.
I mean, sounds pretty nutritious.
It's really good. Yeah, it's really good stuff. It's one of the best composts that we've ever used because it's just got so many different things in it. They've really done a great job with that product. And you know, an inch thick over your strawberry areas. One of the bales is like a 3 cubic foot compressed bale. It'll cover 40 square feet an inch thick. So it goes a lot farther than most of your other composts as well too. So it's really nice stuff. Try and work that into the soil. And not only will it you know, build your soil up, but it also will loosen the soil up. So it's great for breaking up clay soils because it has that gypsum in with it as well too. So great for breaking up the soils. And then depth on the strawberries, you know, if you're doing bare root strawberries, there's definitely an area where the roots stop and there's kind of a crown and then the leaves come out of that crown. Usually want the crown just right at soil level and it's 12 inches apart on the strawberry plants and they'll just go like crazy. One of my neighbors just down the street just planted strawberries earlier in the week and I talked to him yesterday and he's just like, oh, strawberries are just like jumping out of the ground. They're going like crazy. So the bare root strawberries are really easy to do, inexpensive. I think they're like $6 for 25.
Yeah, they're pretty cheap.
I don't think if you wanted to rejuvenate your strawberry bed and you decided to go in and pull all the little runners out and you know pull those out and then rejuvenate the beds and then put the runners back in, I think it's still cheaper to go buy new ones, bare root, than it is to pull those other ones out by the time you do all the work. You might as well just, you know, fertilize and compost and till all those old strawberries up and then, you know, just plop some new ones back in. I mean, for $6, you
well, it seems
that's,
like
that's a lot of plants. Yeah.
The growers pretty much do that every couple of years, don't they?
Oh yeah,
they put in
yeah.
new
just
plants
every 4 or 5 years. It's a good idea just to rejuvenate your strawberry beds. Whether you pull those new baby runners out and salvage those, and then get rid of the old berry plants, and then just transplant your babies back in, or just bring some new plants in and introduce those. And over time, you end up getting grass and weeds and stuff in there that are kind of competing with the strawberries, and they kind of get overgrown, and it's just nice to rejuvenate those beds. You know, add some organic matter, add some fertilizer, and till those beds up, and then start all over, and then all of a sudden your raspberries or strawberries are right back to their most productive point again.
So how far apart should you plant your raspberries?
Raspberries, we go 2 to 3 feet between canes and then 4 to 6 feet between rows. And on the strawberries, about 12 inches between plants. And if you want a nice thick patch, you can just like do one every square foot. And that seems to work just fine.
And should you pinch the runners or even pinch the blossoms off that first year?
That first year, I just kind of let them go. You know, you can pinch the blossoms back or, you know, keep the runners from forming. But, you know, that's like your new crop for next year, so it just kind of—I've just always let those go.
And what about any mulch? What types of mulches?
You know, in the fall, you know, the strawberries really got their name for being mulched with straw in the fall, so they do like to be mulched a little bit. But something that's fairly loose and allows good air circulation. So sometimes the leaves are a little too suffocating.
Dense.
Yeah, because they're a little bit too dense. They just overlap too much. So the straw's good because it's a little bit lighter and fluffier.
Do they need the mulch during the summer? Mm. I mean, I'm just thinking of for the berries to sit on something.
Oh, but yeah. During the summer, not a bad idea. If you want to do a finer, you know, bark mulch, you know, something that's going to allow the water to penetrate through, but it's going
to not allow the slugs to come
in. Yeah, and it really helps the soil retain the moisture. So using a mulch in around your strawberries will be a great idea.
Now, what about something like a pine needle mulch? I'm just wondering if the needles might contain some kind of a resin.
Yeah, the tannins in the needles can cause problems. So if you're using a little bit of pine needles, it wouldn't be too bad. But a lot can start to stunt the growth of your plants. So you got to be careful. So spruce and pines have natural tannins in there that will pretty much stop everything else from growing around them. It's their natural defense system to stop
competition. Kind of like a black walnut.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't use black walnut leaves for anything.
It's a natural competition, so it really slows things down. So, a lot of these defense mechanisms are built into a lot of different plants, and we don't realize that, black walnut leaves are not good. And pine needles in large quantities are not good because those trees create natural toxins that kill everything else. So it's a very good organic weed killer. It just kills everything.
So if you were going to get a variety of strawberries, and I know taste is relative. It depends on what you like, but there are just certain varieties that tend to do better here.
Yeah, yeah.
So what would you recommend?
Fort Laramie's always been very good. You know, it's developed in Wyoming.
So sounds like a high desert.
Yeah,
it's
been very good. But over the years, we've kind of shifted away from Fort Laramie and gone to some of the day neutral varieties because Fort Laramie's an everbearing. And the everbearing, even though they do produce consistently throughout the summer, as our daylight hours get really long during the summertime, it will kind of slow down. It won't produce as much, in that July time period after, our daylight hours really hit their peak at the end of June. They kind of stop there for a while. And then as the daylight hours start to decrease, all of a sudden they're really producing a lot of blossoms again, and then hence a lot of berries. Where day neutral varieties like Hecker and TriStar, And there's another one out there, too. I don't know if Quinault is a day neutral. I think it's an everbearing. But really like the TriStar and the Hecker because they will continuously produce flowers no matter how long the daylight hours get. So they just kind of keep producing. And so we've kind of shifted more towards those the last couple of years because of the heavier production on them. And the quality is just superb. TriStar is really, really good. And Hecker's
so
right there.
How do you keep your plants producing well and getting big berries? What causes your berries to be just kind of small and misshapen? And
yeah, well, sometimes our really hot summers is can cause problems because the blossoms just don't get pollinated properly. The flowers come out first thing in the morning, and if it's 95 degrees, a lot of those flowers that don't get shaded, and if the bees don't get them right away, you can have some blossoms that just fall off and don't get pollinated at all. So that can kind of affect your production as well, too.
So is it mostly a pollination thing? Is that why they look
misshapen?
Because only part of the flower's been pollinated?
Yeah, you definitely want to use a good multi-purpose fertilizer. Like I said, I really like the Iron Plus because it has the nitrogen in there that the berries really, really like, but it has the iron and the sulfur that really helps free up other nutrient, make it available to the plants. So generally between like a little bit of soil activator, the Humate, which has tons of minerals and micros in it already, and the Iron Plus, that's pretty much everything that your plants need. If they've got that good source of micronutrients and nitrogen and iron, especially because if they're iron deficient, then you really have problems with your fruit production. That kind of takes care of all those problems. And then just consistency with watering, make sure that they don't get watered too frequently, but they have a little bit of time to dry out in between waterings, and just be consistent with them so they don't stress for water, but they just aren't too soggy and wet. And that really helps a lot, too, in your production.
So I would imagine then if you're putting your plants in to have a lot of organic matter in the soil?
Yeah, that's why the soil-building compost is so good, because it's got all that organic matter in there. Loosens the soil up, allows for good drainage, which is what the berries like. But they do like consistent watering and a fairly good source of nutrient, and they should produce like crazy for you.
Well, we've reached the halfway point of our program, so we're going to go listen to the latest edition of Wild About Utah. But we'll be back for the rest of the hour with Mark Anderson from Anderson Seed and Garden in Logan. Your toll-free number to call with your questions or comments is 1-800-826-1495.
Welcome to Wild About Utah, a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio.
Hi, this is Mark Larez Casanova from the Utah Master Naturalist Program at Utah State University Extension. Warm springtime weather brings clear trails up in the mountains, and hiking through the shade of Douglas fir on a warm weekend day had me wondering about Utah's national forests and how they came to be. Back in the days of the early pioneers, Utah's mountains were recognized as resources for survival, providing clean water for drinking and irrigation, and lumber for building homes. The high mountain pastures were also valuable summer forage for livestock. In the late 1840s, Parley Pratt declared, "The supply of pasture for grazing animals is without limit in every direction. Millions of people could live in these countries and raise cattle and sheep to any amount." Many settlers shared this view, and unmanaged grazing resulted in deteriorated rangelands in just 20 to 30 years. By 1860, some Utah towns were experiencing regular flooding and heavy erosion due to insufficient vegetation to stabilize the soil. Unregulated timber harvesting during the same period also contributed to these conditions. In 1881, the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Division of Forestry, later renamed Forest Service, was established, and its first job was to gather information about the condition of the nation's forests. In 1902, Albert F. Potter, who was the inspector of grazing for the General Land Office, conducted a survey of potential forest reserves in Utah. Potter stated that the ranges of the state have suffered from a serious drought for several years past, and this, in addition to the very large number of livestock, especially of sheep, has caused the summer range to be left in a very barren condition. The demand for lumber and wool during the First World War again led to increased timber harvesting and grazing on our forests. During the Great Depression of the 1930s, Franklin D. Roosevelt established the Civilian Conservation Corps to help implement conservation projects across the country. The CCC was fundamental in reforesting much of the Wasatch and Uinta mountain ranges, planting over 3 million trees in 9 years. Utah's forest reserves were created in the years soon after Albert Potter's surveys and were gradually combined into Utah's 7 national forests that now cover approximately 10.5 million acres, or about 20% of the state. Grazing and timber harvesting still occur on much of Utah's national forests, but our practices are supported by scientific research and over a century of experience, ensuring more sustainable multiple use and management of our forests today. For Wild About Utah, I'm Mark Larez Casanova.
Wild About Utah is a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio. For transcripts and archived audio of Wild About Utah, go online to upr.org and click on the Wild About Utah link. Support for Wild About Utah comes from the College of Natural Resources at Utah State University. Information is at cnr.usu.edu.
Support for Utah Public Radio comes from USU's Emma Eccles Jones College of Education and Human Services, ranked in the top 2% of graduate schools of education with degrees that include communicative disorders and deaf education. More is at cehs.usu.edu.
Hello and welcome back to Access Utah. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and with me in studio for the next 20 minutes is Mark Anderson from Anderson Seed and Garden in Logan. Please call with your questions or comments to 1-800-826-1495 or go online to upr.org and click on the Programs tab and you'll see the Access Utah link to email your question. So related to strawberries, but other plants as well, if you've got grass coming up in your beds and you'd like to get rid of them, what can you use that is not going to hurt the strawberries?
Yeah, other than your fingers.
Yeah.
grass in a lot of plants, you know, strawberries and raspberries especially, very difficult to remove once it gets in there, especially in ground covers also. I mean, there's grass that will just pop up in those and extremely difficult to get rid of. But there are some grass-specific herbicides that you can use that will just kill grass and won't bother your other plants. So you've got from Fertilome, you've got the over-the-top 2. And from High Yield, there's the High Yield Grass Killer. They will just specifically kill grasses. They won't kill anything else. So I usually tell people, if you spray your lawn with it, it will kill all your lawn and leave all your dandelions. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's pretty much how it works. So if you're spraying it on your strawberries or your raspberries or in your ground cover or your perennials or your bulbs, it will just kill the grass and won't kill anything else. So it doesn't hurt daffodils, daylilies, iris, you know, things that kind of look like grasses but really aren't, but it will kill everything that is a grass. So if you have an ornamental blue fescue or some lovely ornamental grasses like Carl Forrester or corn, which is also in the grass family, it will kill all of those. So you have to be a little careful with it, but for the most part, it will just selectively kill the grass and won't kill the other stuff.
Now, you were mentioning during the break that it does need to be on aggressively growing grass,
yeah.
Not old grass.
Yeah, that's when it works the best. So older grasses, as the grass gets taller and older and thicker and more coarse, it will be losing its effectiveness. It won't work quite as well. It'll still work. It's going to take longer. It's just not going to work as well. But not so much temperature sensitive as it is. We want young, aggressively growing, vigorous grasses.
So right now.
Yeah, right now is the best time to get after those grasses. And then once you get the grass under control, there are certain pre-emergents that you can use to stop new grasses from coming up. Of course, there are some very good organic pre-emergents, like the corn gluten. Have you ever used the corn gluten?
I haven't. Yeah, I've seen it in the gardens alive and
the
stuff.
The corn gluten does a really good job. It's only going to last about a month. I mean, the pre-emergent properties to it. But it does have a natural nitrogen source in there. So a very slow release. Slow release nitrogen. But good nitrogen source for plants. And about a month's worth of pre-emergent. So that's a possibility if you want to stick with some organic options.
So when you say pre-emergent, is this basically for those grasses that are seed or any seed
anything
at all?
Anything that's coming up from seed.
So quack grass, it's not going to keep that from coming up.
If it's coming up from root system, no. If it's coming up from seed, yes. And so it's basically as the seed pops open and the germ comes out and starts to root, it basically kills the germ on most weeds. It won't work on 100%, but it works on a lot. So it really cuts your weed control. I mean, it really boosts your weed control by a lot.
But you want to be doing this, like, what, a couple of weeks before you plant your own seeds? How much time should you leave between?
Well, I would get my seeds in and germinated and up
first,
and growing,
okay.
And then use your pre-emergent. Like, if you're using the corn gluten, it'll pretty much stop everything from coming up. So you have to be really careful with that one and not do it before you're going to be planting seed.
But it won't last through till next year.
No. But if you're planting plants, that wouldn't bother those plants at all because it really doesn't affect existing, you know, established root system of plants. So that would be okay. If you move to something like Treflan, which you can also use around a lot of edibles, the Treflan works for about 2 months and basically does the same thing that the corn gluten does, just in a different way. And you can use it around a lot of vegetables and ornamentals to stop new weeds from coming up. So after you get the grass killed out with your grass killer, then you can put a pre-emergent down to stop new grasses from coming up from seed. And as the grass killer really works, the grass will turn yellow. It takes about 2 to 3 weeks. I mean, it's not a spray, watch it die the next day type deal. I mean, it takes time. Usually it takes at least 2, if not 3 applications at about a week's interval. So this is one you have to be patient with and do multiple applications to really get good control with it. But once that grass starts to yellow, you can basically just grab it and just yank right out. I mean, it has no root system left to it. So it's easy to pull that dead grass out and just remove it, then put a pre-emergent down, stop new weeds from coming up. In raspberries, you could actually use a product called Cazeron, and the Cazeron won't bother the raspberries. In fact, you can use it on anything that has bark on it, so shrubs and trees, you know, anything that's got a woody bark or woody stem to it, and canes, roses, grapes, raspberries, blackberries, but it basically will damage or kill everything else. And so you can use it in your raspberries, and it will actually kill a lot of weeds that are there already and stop new ones from coming up for the rest of the summer.
What about field bindweed?
It will kill bindweed.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it kills bindweed. I've got a couple of customers who come in, and they have a lot of ground cover type junipers. So they've got Calgary carpets and some buffalo junipers that, you know, cover a large area. And once you start to get bindweed in there, I mean, you can't get it out. Yeah, and so we got them to start using the Cazeron a few years ago, and it basically killed out all their bindweed, didn't bother their junipers, and now they don't have hardly any weeds at all in their junipers because it's got that woody stem to it, so the Cazeron's okay to use in there. It won't bother those plants at all, but it sure stops weeds from coming up for the rest of the year. It's a great way to really save yourself a lot of work.
That's what I'm thinking. My daughter would especially love this in the raspberries because that's her job to keep those weeded.
Yeah,
so
it works really well in the raspberries. You have to get it on before the new shoots come up. So it's,
okay,
almost,
it's a little late now.
It's almost too late this year where things have really moved along quickly. Usually we're good up to about the first part of May, but this year things are moving along a little bit faster, so we might be past that.
I was going to say my berries are probably up a good 6 inches.
Yeah, so you might be past that.
Okay, well, she'll just have extra
work
this year.
For next year. You want to get it on fairly early because it really stops a ton of weeds and really will save you a lot of work.
Okay, dandelions. I was looking at a full carpet of dandelions back in an area that I just don't usually worry about.
They're flourishing this year.
But their seeds will blow over to the areas that I do worry about, so I'd like to get them taken care of.
Yeah.
So if you've got dandelions growing, what's just any weed in your lawn?
Yeah. Yeah, so since we talked about grass killer, you know, we
don't want to use
that. We don't want to use that on there, but that'll kill the grass without killing the broadleaf. But then we can switch to something that kills the broadleaf without affecting the grasses, and there's a lot of options that way too. You know, if you don't have too many weeds, I still love to use my little weed digger. I mean, that works just about as well as anything if you don't have a ton of weeds. So if you're just like hitting a few here and there, it works as well as anything. Go out there and just pop those dandelions out.
Now, how do you have to get the entire root, or will it start growing again?
Difficult with the weeder to get the entire root because the root goes down deep enough. But if you cut it off and it doesn't have any leaves up on top and it's a younger plant and the root's not too deep, you can pretty much get rid of them with just the one shot, and they, for the most part, won't come back. If they're bigger, established ones, you know, with a really big root system, and they might come back. it's always a possibility. But, you know, if you have a large area and you're trying to get those under control, there's some fairly recent innovations in broadleaf weed control that do a great job. Trimec has been around for quite a while. It's a combination of three different weed killers. And so it's got three very effective herbicides in there that would just work on broadleaf weeds. So it won't hurt your turf, it won't hurt your grass, but it'll get clover and dandelions and purslane and, you know, a lot of different weeds that have snuck into the lawn. If you have some harder to kill weeds like morning glory or wild violets or, you know, big thistles and, you know, burr buttercup, you know, a lot of the really difficult stuff, then you'd want to switch to something like the Weed Free Zone, which has four different weed killers in there, and it's very, very effective on these hard to kill weeds. Works quicker, works in cooler temperatures. So even if your daytime temperatures are only in the high 40s, it's still going to kill all those weeds.
Will it work in higher temperatures?
It works in higher temperatures.
Okay, so you can
too.
Use it all season
long.
Yeah,
up to about 90. If it starts getting above 90, I really don't like using broadleaf weed killers because it can burn your grass. You just have to be really careful in the middle of summer. In fact, unless I absolutely have to, I just won't use the broadleaf weed killers in the summer. They're just too volatile. And when it gets hot like that, they can vaporize and spread. And then you watch your trees and your shrubs and just the leaves curling up and getting damaged. So it's really best if you try and use it when the temperatures are below 90. But with the Weed Free Zone, you can do it down to about 45 degrees, and it'll still work like crazy.
Well, we only have about 8 minutes left in the program. If you want to get in a question or comment, we need you to call now if you can at 1-800-826-1495. That's 1-800-826-1495, or go online to upr.org, click on the Access Utah program tab, and email us your question. So with this broadleaf leaf killer, how effective is it in the spring. I know in the fall, it seems like the best time because the plants are drawing their nutrients down and they pull that poison right in. If I'm doing it in the spring right now, for instance, all of those stupid violets that I thought I had cleared out have just
come back.
They've just spread. In a couple of years, they've just come right back to the point where it chokes out the lawn.
So they will work effectively.
My daughter won't like me because she likes little purple
flowers.
I want them out. Yeah. So
the, your weed-free zone especially works very effectively in the springtime, but fall is the best time. They'll be even more effective in the fall. So,
I need to hit it now and then...
And then follow up in the fall.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. And in many cases, aggressive weeds like the wild violets are producing from root system as well as from seed. And so you can kill off what you've got in your lawn, and it may not be coming back from the root system of those plants. It may be coming up from seed because all the little cute purple flowers are producing seeds as well, too.
If there were just a few here and there, I'd leave them in.
It wouldn't be so bad, but they are pretty aggressive, so they go like crazy. So, spring is a good time to get a lot of weeds under control, keep your lawn fairly weed-free through the summer, but fall is the most effective time to try and control those aggressive, difficult to control weeds.
We have Derek from Lewiston. Hi, Derek. How can we help?
Oh, I'm getting ready to plant a bunch of potatoes this year, and I've been doing a little bit of research online, and there seems to be quite a different variety of, you know, methods of planting. I'm just wondering what you'd recommend for the Cache Valley area.
Yeah, we generally will plant about 6 inches deep on the potatoes, so we'll dig our holes about 6 inches deep and go 12 inches apart, and just one piece with 1 to 2 eyes per piece on your potatoes will work great. And then we go 3 to 4 feet between rows. I like to be able to run the tiller down in between the rows. And so we'll put them a little bit farther apart because we got the extra space. So it's like, what the heck? We'll try and make it easy. So that works out very, very well. So did you have some other options in mind?
There was one article I was reading. They talked about mounding, you know, heaping up straw or various things. Mulch, and I'm just wondering how effective that is.
And we do
actually tried that.
Yeah, and we do that too. So as our potatoes start to grow and they get, 8 to 12 inches tall, as we furrow down the sides of the potatoes, I've got like a little moldboard plow cultivator that we kind of push, and it makes furrows that we can run the water down. But I'll push the dirt over on top of the potatoes, so we'll gradually mound those up through the summer as we furrow. And where you cover the potatoes up, they'll actually produce more potatoes out to the side. So as the plants get bigger, you can actually cover those plants up and get more production out of your potatoes. But you have to fertilize a little bit more, too. So
great. Hey, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Thanks for your call. What do you and how often do you usually fertilize your potatoes?
You know, when we first plant, I'll put like a tablespoon of bone meal down in the bottom of the potatoes.
We'll treat them like a flower, like it's a
yeah. Well,
I mean, it is a tuber, so
yeah. The bone meal is really super slow release phosphorus, and it'll basically feed the potatoes all summer long with the phosphorus they need to develop, good healthy root system and tubers, which is really what we want on the potatoes. So by doing that, you'll almost increase your yield by about 50% just by putting that down the bottom of your potatoes. And then a little bit of nitrogen through the summertime to keep the leaf growth, the top growth going. And and that really, really helps if you're going to be mounting your potatoes up because you got to get a lot of top growth.
Just kind of side dress
it. Yeah, just kind of side dress it. And sometimes we'll use just like a little 16, 16, 16, something's got a little bit of everything in it. And and then mound those up and your potatoes will go like crazy.
So I've noticed that with some potato varieties, at least in my garden, some do better than others. The Yukon Golds, I just love.
Good.
They just do really well.
Yeah, they're always
Pontiacs,
good.
I get like one or two huge potatoes, but not a whole lot of others. And then the plants die back because I must have some kind of a wilt in the soil.
Have you ever used the mycorrhiza in with
your
potatoes?
I did, and I must have it really bad because it didn't really work for my potatoes. And my watermelon, same thing. I get the dieback with the watermelon.
Because we had really good results with the mycorrhiza, keeping the diseases from bothering those. And then it just makes the plants so healthy, they just produce like crazy. We did mycorrhiza in with our potatoes last year, and we got probably off of 10 pounds of potatoes, I'll bet we got over 150 pounds of yield back on them. So they just produced like crazy.
Yukons, I never have any problems with. I always
get
a
ton.
But the
other ones do. Switch to maybe Lesota for the red instead of the Pontiac. because it's probably a little bit more resistant, and don't do Norlin because it's the most susceptible to it. And then when
Norlin, though, I usually, if I put them in, I just like, do that for
like
early potatoes.
Them. You're eating them before they get affected by it. But the other thing you can do is if you're having disease issues with your potatoes is when you cut your potatoes, let them heal overnight before you plant them. So always cut them the day before you're going to plant and let them heal overnight. And then you can dust them before you plant them, either with a little bit of dusting sulfur or with Captan. And that will also help prevent the diseases from entering into the potatoes so quickly and causing problems. You know, it's not going to prevent it entirely, but it's going to slow things down so that your potatoes have enough time to mature and produce before they're affected by the disease. So that would really help also.
And it's not always available, but when I come in, I tend to say, could I get, you know, so many pounds of this potato, but... Mm-hmm. Give me all the small ones.
Get them as small as you can.
Yeah, because then I don't have to cut them up.
Yeah, and if you don't cut them, then it's less likely for the disease to enter in through the fresh cuts. So that's a possibility,
but
too.
But it's a good idea to make them heal
overnight. Yeah, so if you cut your potatoes, cut them the day before, let them heal overnight, and they'll actually kind of develop a natural film over the potato that'll prevent some diseases and other issues from happening, so...
Do you have any newer potato varieties? Anything? What's coming out new?
Yeah. Last year we had a variety that was called Rosetta that we got, and that was really, really good. And I've been trying to get some more of those in, but I haven't been able to yet. But
apparently everybody else has found out about them.
I don't know. I've been calling the guys, but they haven't brought me any over yet. So they're out of Lewiston. So I'll call and bug them again today because I've got a lot of people that are looking for them. So we'll see what we can come up with.
Okay, so in 90 seconds... tell me what's the best new thing to plant this year that you think people ought to try.
I would have,
or new within the last couple of years.
Yeah, I would have to say if you haven't tried Optimum Corn, that's one that you really should try because it's just so productive.
Is it a super sweet?
It's a super sweet.
So you want to wait till the soil's warmed up.
This was one that can germinate in cooler soil temperatures.
Wow.
It will produce 2, 3, and sometimes even 4 ears per stalk.
No way.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's,
okay,
it's
you're
amazing.
On. I'm going to plant this and see what happens.
Side dress,
lucky to get 1.5.
Side dress 3 times during the growing season with nitrogen. You'll get 3 or 4 ears per stalk.
And how far apart should the stalks be?
2 seeds every 12 inches in the row, 3 to 4 feet between rows. And you'll have the best corn you've ever eaten. We pulled some out of the freezer the other day that we froze last summer, and it was as good as when we put it in the bags.
So could I have 2 rows, like say a foot apart, and then 3 to 4 feet in between?
You could probably.
I like to water down the middle.
You could probably do that.
Yeah,
you could probably do that, and that'd work out fine. But needs that extra nitrogen. But this is an amazing variety of corn. Yeah.
Okay.
And Orient Express cucumber, my all-time favorite cucumber.
That's one I haven't tried.
It's the best. Yeah, Orient Express is amazing. It's
Mark.
Really good.
We've reached the end of the time. Thanks for coming in.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
You've been listening to Access Utah. Mark Anderson from Anderson Seed and Garden in Logan has been my guest. Thank you for joining us on this edition of Access Utah.
Don't let a tight budget stop you from starting seeds indoors. Get creative and involve family and friends in the process. Hi, I'm Melinda Myers, horticulturist and gardening expert. Share swap seeds. Most packets have more seeds than one gardener needs. Or offer to start seeds for your favorite gardener. They may be willing to fund the experience in return for your time and effort raising transplants for you and them. Recycle paper cups, yogurt containers, and other fast food containers into seed starting planters. Just clean and punch holes in the bottom for drainage. Or create your own pots from newspaper. Fold squares of paper into pots using origami or roll strips of paper into containers. Wrap 3 to 4 inch wide strips of newspaper around a 2 inch diameter or bigger dowel rod, rolling pin, or juice glass. Fold up the bottom edge to form a bottom. Fill with a well-drained potting mix and set in a flat tray or saucer. Check out our website for this and other gardening tips.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1, 89.5 Logan. KUSK HD1, 88.5 Vernal. KUSL HD1, 89.3 Richfield. KUST HD1, 88.7 Moab. And KUSU FM HD1, 91.5 Logan.
Support for Utah Public Radio comes from area-info.net. Providing a social media outlet for personalized national, financial, and lifestyle news. and travel and entertainment. Information is at area-info.net.